Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, in January 2020, Congressman Adam Schiff led a team of House managers in laying out the evidence against Donald Trump during his first impeachment trial. As chair of the House Intelligence Committee, the six-term Democrat from California had followed the rise of autocracy around the world for years. He argued in front of the Senate that Trump's abuse of presidential power showed those same anti-democratic forces had arrived in the U.S. In a new book titled Midnight in Washington, Schiff makes the case this threat to democracy has not ended with the change of administration. The forces that led to the January 6th insurrection are still present, he says, and must be addressed. Representative Adam Schiff joined me Friday morning, shortly after the House passed President Biden's Build Back Better bill. Congressman Schiff, welcome to the podcast. Build Back Better passed in the House early this morning. What were your reactions when it finally passed? I gather by a fairly slim margin, 220 to 213.
I was thrilled that it passed. This is really the new deal for this generation. It's going to help parents afford childcare. It's going to provide universal pre-K, early childhood education. It's going to help seniors with hearing aids and with insulin. It's going to bring down the cost of prescription drugs and healthcare for everyone. It's going to help a lot of taxpayers who lost their state and local tax deductions. And it's paid for by a more equitable tax code that doesn't let some of the most lucrative companies in the world get away without paying any tax. So I think it's a tremendous win. And when coupled with the infrastructure bill and the rescue plan, the most sizable investment in the American people since the New Deal.
I'm so glad you talked a bit about what's in it, so our listeners can understand that. The Congressional Budget Office did come out with saying that the increase in the budget deficit would be $160 billion over 10 years. So the whole package becomes $2.1 trillion instead of $1.85 trillion over 10 years. Now, what's your reaction to that?
Well, as I understand it, the Congressional Budget Office figures out the costs, but is not allowed to consider the revenue raisers. And the Treasury Department estimates that the investment we're making in IRS enforcement, so that people are required to pay their fair share of their taxes, more than offsets the cost of the bill and, in fact, ends up reducing our national debt. And now, both the Congressional Budget Office and I think the White House and Treasury are all operating on certain economic assumptions and assumptions about how the programs will be applied. That is more of an art than a science. But it certainly looks like the bill is fully paid for, which is in sharp contrast to what Republicans did when they controlled the House and Senate and passed a $2 trillion tax cut measure for very wealthy families and corporations that was completely unpaid for and dramatically increased the national debt.
And on whom will these taxes fall?
Well, they won't fall on anyone, any family making less than $400,000. Where they will fall is there's a new corporate minimum tax so that you don't have some very large companies essentially paying no tax. And it also repeals some of the provisions of the Trump tax cut that benefited the wealthiest American families. So it's a much more equitable sharing of the tax burden. And the net effect is to not only reduce the deficit, but also pay for these incredible investments in the American people, helping young people pay for college and young families afford quality childcare so that parents can re-enter the job market.
Are you at all concerned that corporations and wealthy individuals can still find ways to avoid paying these taxes?
I'm sure that there are some ways they will still find to try to avoid paying taxes, but there will be fewer opportunities to do that. We may have to adjust in the future. If they come up with new loopholes to exploit, we'll have to close those loopholes too. At the end of the day, we just want to make sure that, you know, everyone is paying a fair share, and that the code doesn't leave people in poverty. One of the things that I find so dramatic about this bill and the rescue plan that we passed earlier is that we lift half the children in poverty in this country out of poverty with a single provision that simply expands the child tax credit. It's not rocket science, and we're using our majority to lift kids out of poverty through the tax code. They use their majority to give 83% of the benefit of a $2 trillion tax cut to 1% of the population. It just shows the different priorities of the parties.
Before passage of the bill was announced this morning, Congressman Kevin McCarthy took the floor for some 8.5 hours talking about why this bill should not be passed, among other things that he talked about. Were you on the floor at the time he was speaking?
I was on the floor for part of his remarks, but cut quickly bored. I think never has someone taken so long to say so little and with such malice. It was really a bizarre spectacle to essentially try to filibuster against early childhood education, to try to filibuster against helping parents pay for childcare, and filibuster against helping seniors with their insulin needs or their hearing aids. A bizarre demonstration of what he was against without, you know, much explanation of anything he was for. So I think it left people perplexed. The goal seemed to be to talk long enough so that the bill would have to be taken up in the middle of the night and then blame Democrats for taking up the bill in the middle of the night. So we simply put off the vote until the morning.
And what time did you actually vote?
We voted around 8:30, 9 o'clock this morning.
So how was it that Congressman McCarthy could go on for 8.5 hours?
The House has what's called a magic minute, which is reserved for the Speaker and the Minority Leader, meaning they have 1 minute to speak, but that 1 minute can last forever. And boy, I'll tell you, that 1 minute seemed to last forever.
Wow.
Yes. And I can tell you there was no magic to that minute.
Now, let me take you back to yesterday and the announcement of the taking away of committee chairmanships and privileges to Congressman Gosar. Can you talk about that whole episode, what that animated cartoon was about, and why 9 Republicans stood in the well with Congressman Gosar as he was taken from his committee privileges?
Well, Paul Gosar, for reasons that are hard to fathom, produced an anime showing him killing one of our colleagues, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and also threatening the president. And unfortunately, in this environment where we've already had a violent attack on the Capitol, there are all too many threats on members' lives. And I can speak to that very personally. There have been innumerable threats against my life and the lives of my family. And so we have a zero tolerance against members threatening other members. Now, why would they defend that? That's where the GOP is right now. The glorification of violence, the promulgation of a big lie about our elections that led to violence. They are sadly not a party of ideas anymore, or ideology, or conservatism. They're an anti-truth cult around the former president. The only discipline they've been talking about in terms of their members is they're talking about disciplining Republican members who voted for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And why? Because they think it would help the country and therefore help Joe Biden. And so the Republican Party under Kevin McCarthy and Donald Trump is in this bizarre place where voting for a bipartisan bill to fix our roads and bridges and highways is considered treachery, but glorifying violence against fellow members of Congress is A-okay. Indeed, McCarthy suggested that if they were to take over the majority, he would not only give Gosar and Marjorie Taylor Greene their committees back, but give them better committees. That's the kind of lack of leadership and craven quality to McCarthy and Trump's GOP.
Hasn't in the past even stronger action been taken against members who do something as shameful as this was? Haven't some members actually been thrown out of the Congress? Did you see that as a possibility?
There have been times where Congress has used the remedy of expulsion. It's pretty rare, and it is something that we considered as potentially appropriate given the threats embodied in what Gosar put together. I think what we did was, you know, very responsible. Of course, the Republican reaction is, if you're going to expel our members for legitimate reasons, then we're going to threaten to expel yours for illegitimate ones. It's not unlike the situation around the debate over executive privilege. The Biden administration has said, with respect to the work of the January 6th committee, it will not assert executive privilege to keep the facts from the American people. And the Republican response is, well, then we will abuse that by going after Biden administration officials if we should take the majority. And I think the answer to that is they can't be allowed to govern, ever, not as long as they're an anti-truth, autocratic cult of the former president.
You've led me directly to my next question, and that is regarding where are we with the January 6th committee's investigation of what happened with the refusal of some of the witnesses you've called to come to testify? Is calling them in contempt of Congress enough? Is 4 months in jail enough? Will you be able to get the information you need?
We held Steve Bannon in criminal contempt and made a criminal referral to the Justice Department, and they're prosecuting him, which they should. No one is above the law, but for 4 years, Steve Bannon was given the impression that he was. He was indicted for stealing from Donald Trump's own supporters, who sent in money to build a wall that Donald Trump said that Mexico was going to pay for, but obviously wasn't going to. And when he was indicted for that, Donald Trump pardoned him for stealing from his own people. No wonder he feels above the law. When he came before Congress during the Russia investigation, when it was led by Republicans, he refused to answer any questions not written out for him by the White House. That was the subject of our investigation. And when he did that, Republicans refused to do anything about it. So he had good reason to feel he was above the law, because for 4 years he was. But that changed when we had a Justice Department suddenly that believed in the rule of law again. And the prosecution of Steve Bannon has already had a very salutary effect on other witnesses and their willingness to cooperate. They don't want to be Steve Bannon. They don't want to risk going to jail. And so I think it's already had a very positive impact on the investigation.
Who might you call next? What have you learned so far to lead you to your next witness?
I'm not at liberty to talk about which witnesses we may bring in next. And I am somewhat limited in what I can say in terms of what we're learning. But I can tell you this, because it's been the subject of a Senate public investigation as well. You know, among other things, we learned that there were efforts at the highest levels of the Justice Department to use that department to aid the president's efforts to overturn the election, which is a shocking thing. Efforts to use the Justice Department to promulgate the big lie about massive fraud. Efforts to get states like Georgia to delay the appointment of electors so they would not be in time for the joint session, or to even appoint a different slate of electors, and potentially a plan to follow on with that approach with other states. Something that in and of itself would be just unthinkable and scandalous, that the Department of Justice, which is supposed to serve the interests of justice was being endeavored to be used to thwart a peaceful transfer of power. It just is shocking. So we are learning a great deal. It's our goal to have further public hearings and inform the public of what we're learning, and also produce a report and set of recommendations that will hopefully keep the country better protected in the future.
Are you continuing those hearings even now, or have you broken until after the holidays?
Oh, no, we're continuing them. We've been interviewing people almost every day, sometimes multiple times a day. And we have planned interviews in the days ahead. So we're moving with all urgency.
What's your ultimate goal?
Ultimate goal is to reveal for the American people everything that went into that tragic day, all those who were responsible and the ways in which they were responsible, and to better protect our democracy going forward. There's still so much we don't know, in particular about the former president's understanding of those who were amassing on the Mall and their propensity for violence, in terms of what he was doing during that day when the Capitol was being attacked and why reinforcements were not sent, and the role of members of Congress. Nothing is off limits. We're going to investigate all the facts and follow the evidence wherever it leads us.
But as with Steve Bannon, who was claiming executive privilege, couldn't this just go on and on with legal challenges, court challenges? I mean, this could go on for years.
You know, that is certainly the former president's desire. And the litigation that he's using is designed to, much as he did during the last 4 years, stonewall all the subpoenas. And, you know, I think the courts recognize that he is endeavoring to delay, to deny the American people the facts. And they're moving with great expedition. The district court already ruled in our favor. The Court of Appeals has an accelerated schedule for argument. So I think the court understands how it was abused by Donald Trump for 4 years. Indeed, during the last 4 years, we saw a breakdown of so many of our democratic institutions. And this is something that I wrote about in a book that just came out, and how close we are to losing our democracy. What concerns me most is this effort right now around the country to strip independent elections officials of their duties and give them over to partisans. They seem determined that if they couldn't find a Secretary of State in Georgia who would come up with 11,780 votes that don't exist, the next time they're determined to have someone who will.
So, following up on your book, tell me how close you believe we came to losing our democracy in that last election.
I think we came very close to losing our democracy. Indeed, the title of the book is Midnight in Washington, how close we came to losing our democracy and why we still could. And we came very close because there were any number of breakpoints. What if, for example, the Secretary of State of Georgia had acquiesced in the president's demand that he come up with just enough votes to beat Joe Biden? What if the state legislators in Pennsylvania adhered to his demands to send an alternate slate of electors, or local elections officials in Michigan held up the vote, or elections officials in Maricopa defrauded the public by caving in to the former president's demands? And what if we had lost a few more seats in the House and Kevin McCarthy had been Speaker? He would have overturned the result in the House and we would be in chaos. Any one of those were real breakpoints in the system. And rather than repudiate what went on, when we saw what a terrible end Donald Trump and Trumpism brought the country, literally to a violent attack on the seat of our Capitol, the response has been to double down. The response has been to try to succeed next time in overturning the election where they failed in the last. And this is what has to be guarded against. I wrote the book because we have taken our democracy for granted for a long time and believe that it was self-effectuating. And we have learned the hard way over the last 4 years, there's nothing self-effectuating about it. It must be fought for and protected as every generation has in the past.
And the second part of that title, "And We Still Could," the question becomes, what about all the gerrymandering that's already been done prior to the 2022 congressional elections? Aren't you concerned about that?
I am very concerned about it. I discuss in the book a number of anti-majoritarian institutions that are really hobbling our democracy. One of them, of course, is the one you raise, which is the gerrymander. Because of the gerrymander, for much of each decade, the House of Representatives is led by a party that represents the minority view of Americans, not a majority of Americans, because they have drawn districts to essentially freeze in minority rule. The Senate is already a minority-based institution because 23% of the country's population in the rural areas controls 60% of the votes in the Senate. You add a filibuster to that, that archaic rule, and you have minority rule on top of minority rule. Because of the Electoral College, the President of the United States is often a person who lost the popular vote. And of course, the Supreme Court is now the least representative body in the country. How long can a democracy survive, let alone thrive, if each of its institutions are governed by a minority of Americans? And so all of these things need to be reformed. And sadly, the clock is ticking away. The gerrymandering is going on as we speak. People are being disenfranchised around the country with these new Jim Crow laws. And elections officials are being stripped of their responsibilities, and they're given over to partisan boards and partisan legislatures in the most frontal assault on our democracy in memory. And this is how democracies come to an end. It's not always through violent means. Often it's by using the instruments of a democracy against itself, as we see today in Hungary.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Congressman Adam Schiff.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Adam Schiff. He represents California's 28th District in Congress. His new book is titled Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. So let's take just one item you've mentioned, and that's voting rights. Where do we go with repairing that system, which it seems that some members of Congress want to reduce in terms of who gets to vote, where they vote, how they vote? I mean, this is, as you say, critical to our democracy. How are Democrats, how is the Republic going to deal with the issue of voting rights?
You're absolutely right. Voting rights are an existential issue for our democracy, as they are indeed for any democracy. If the foundation isn't solid, then the whole edifice comes down. And right now there is an attack on those rights around the country using the guise of this big lie about the election. Republican legislators are ushering in this new generation of laws meant to disenfranchise particularly people of color. And there are two things that have to be done about it. We have to fight this in every state. We have to make sure that everyone can overcome any obstacle put in their way. But we also need federal legislation designed to strike down these efforts to prevent people from voting. All the Democrats support that. All the Republicans oppose it. The Republican Party right now has become an anti-democratic party. They celebrate the wannabe dictator in Hungary, Viktor Orban, as the model now to be followed. They realize their policies are backward and unpopular, and their only hope of holding power is to discourage people from voting and make it more difficult. Now, all the Democrats support voting rights, but some put a stronger preference on this archaic rule of the filibuster, and at the moment have been unwilling to carve out an exception for the filibuster. And I think that the only way past that impasse is for the president to persuade both Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema that the conservatives are more than willing to carve out exceptions to stack the Supreme Court with conservative justices. And there's nothing more important than protecting the right to vote. If there's going to be any exception in the filibuster, it ought to be for this. I would urge the administration to redouble their efforts. I think it's going to require nothing less than the president's personal and persistent attention to Joe Manchin, to Kyrsten Sinema, to make sure that we get this done and get it done without any delay.
So you've taken me to that most important question of how Build Back Better is going to be dealt with in the Senate. How close do you think we are, even with Senator Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, how close are we to having this bill go down?
I think we're very close to getting it passed in the Senate. We'll have to wait to see whether there are any provisions in particular that Manchin or Sinema object to, and what can be done to work out any differences over that. I think those provisions, I hope, will be small in number and the differences will be minor, but I don't know that to be the case. And it's a great frustration to those of us in the House that two senators have such a disproportionate say in the policy of the country. But the math is what the math is. And from my point of view, the remedy, if we're unhappy with the math, is to change the math by electing more Democrats to the Senate, Democrats who will ultimately do away with a filibuster. If we can't do everything the country needs with only 50 Democratic senators, we need to make it 55 or 60 or whatever it will take. But in the meantime, we need to work with these two colleagues to get them to yes, because every provision of this bill is popular with the American people. And is
what
necessary.
What is it that's preventing those two senators now from voting yes? Is it coal? What is it?
I don't know. They haven't been very clear in terms of provisions of this latest bill. So I think we'll have to wait and see. A lot of the input that they provided earlier in the process has already been incorporated into the bill. So, for example, on the issue of climate that you bring up, there was originally a proposal, which I liked a great deal, to require power plants to produce more clean power. And it was a mandate that they do so. That was objected to by Senator Manchin. And now there is a strong program of incentives rather than mandates to get us to the same goal. So some of those objections have already been taken into consideration. What more objections they may have, I don't know, but I am confident we will get to yes, and whatever that ultimate agreement is, it will be a big and transformative bill for the American people.
Is it going to take the president to persuade those two senators, or can it be done within the Democratic caucus itself?
I think the president has an indispensable role to play. And he's been a big player in this all along, in the original drafting of the provisions and the negotiation over them. But he's not done yet. I think he's going to have to do more work with these two senators to make sure that we can get them to yes, and that we can do so in a way that preserves what's most important about this bill.
And do you believe nothing is going to happen in the Senate until after the first of the year?
Oh, no. I fully hope and expect that we will get this done before the end of the year. We have a lot of other things to do, too, to keep the government open, to make sure to raise the debt ceiling. And so there are a bunch of must-dos, and I consider this one of those for president again.
You've been very generous with your time, Congressman. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the American people before we close?
I just want to, tell you why I wrote the book Midnight in Washington. There's been a lot written about what happened in the White House during the Trump years, but very little written about what happened in Congress. And had not Republican members in Congress enabled what Donald Trump did, he could have never broken down so many of our democratic institutions. He could have never put our democracy at such risk. And I wanted to write about how that happens. How do good people allow themselves to be so badly used? Robert Caro, the historian, once said in an interview that power doesn't corrupt as much as it reveals. It doesn't always reveal us for our best, but it says a lot about who we are. And power, over the last 4 years, has revealed a lot about people that I served with that I think the public should know so that they can see how this happens. There's no flaw in the Constitution that I can identify. I wouldn't rewrite the impeachment clause so that we can remove presidents with a majority vote and turn the Congress into a parliament. But at the end of the day, the system depends on people living up to their oath, giving it meaning through ideas of right and wrong, and being willing to recognize the truth. And if they're not, then none of it works. And this, in my view, is what has us on such fragile ground right now. But I did title the book Midnight in Washington because midnight may be the darkest hour of every day, but it's also a time of hope because you know that what comes after is filled with light, and we are going to get through this. I think when you're in crisis, it's hard to see how it ends and sometimes to see even if it'll end, but it will end, and what we do in this moment will determine how quickly this time passes.
Can you give me a single example of something that went on within the Congress that the American people do not yet realize?
Well, I think that what the public may not have been able to see taking place under the dome and in some cases taking place three floors below the Capitol, in the space where the Intelligence Committee meets, the affectionately called bunker, was the transformation that took place with members. How they came to shed their beliefs, their ideology, their values, even their morality, in the service of this most unethical of presidents. I saw an interview recently that Steve Scalise did with Chris Wallace in which he was asked repeatedly, can he just say the election wasn't stolen? And he couldn't bring himself to do this. The number two Republican in the House couldn't bring himself to admit the election wasn't stolen. And I watched that interview and I thought to myself, I can't imagine that when Steve Scalise decided to run for Congress years ago, that he said to himself, I want to run for Congress so that one day I can be part of a big lie that undermines the fabric of our democracy. And yet there he is. And how does that happen? And people need to know how that happens. And not surprisingly, it happens one small lie followed by a bigger one, one small act of immorality followed by a bigger one until you're so far in that you can't see your way out again. And we need to find a way through this. And I believe we will, because the stories that I tell in the book also of the heroes that have come out of this are more important than the stories of the villains. And there are millions and millions more Americans who love and cherish our democracy than those at the moment who are trying to tear it down.
Wasn't there an incident that took place between you and Kevin McCarthy when you were in conversation and you said something and he totally reversed your quote in public?
Yes, and I told this story in the book because I'm frequently asked by people whether the Republicans really believe what they say in public when you talk to them in private. And I had a very revealing conversation with Kevin McCarthy about 10 years ago, sitting on a plane And in this respect, it was very much a precursor of things to come. It was a nothing of a conversation about who was going to win the midterms that were then 6 months away. And I said the Democrats were going to win, and he said the Republicans were going to win. And I thought nothing of it. And we got to Washington and went our separate ways. And he went off and gave a briefing to the press, and he told the press that Republicans were going to win. Everybody knew it. He'd just been on the plane with Adam Schiff, and even Adam Schiff admitted Republicans were going to win. And this came out in the morning, and I was just incredulous. And I rushed up to him on the House floor, and I said, Kevin, I would have thought if we're having a private conversation, we were having a private conversation. But if we weren't, you know, I told you the exact opposite of what you told the press. And he looks at me and he says, yeah, I know, Adam, but you know how it goes. And I said, no, Kevin, I don't know how it goes. You just make stuff up and that's how you operate, because that's not how I operate. But that is how he operates. And in that sense, he was made for a moment like this, when the truth is of no consequence in his party, when his party leader believes the truth isn't truth and everybody's entitled to their own alternate facts. That's the current morality, or lack thereof, of today's Trumpian GOP. And it is a real danger. Of all the corrosive damage that Trump did to our democracy, nothing has been more destructive than this relentless assault on the truth. I find, you know, some of those interactions very revealing in what they say about people, but also what they say about the health of our democracy.
And yet there is talk that Trump is planning to run again in 2024 for the presidency of the United States.
Oh, I think he is absolutely running. And for a couple of reasons, I think that it would be intolerable to him to see anyone else get that attention. You can imagine how out of his mind he would go if he were watching Mike Pence or Nikki Haley or Chris Christie or any of these people as the Republican nominee for president. It would drive him out of his mind. So I think he pathologically cannot not run. I also think that he probably feels that it's a great moneymaker. He's raising a lot of money, and some of it raised in ways that he can use to feather his own nest. And he may also feel that running for president, being relevant, is the best way for him to stay one step ahead of the jailer. That as long as he's a candidate, he is effectively too big to jail. So I think we have to fully understand that he's running. We cannot underestimate him the way we did in 2016, because should he ever claim power again, this country will look nothing like it has looked before, in the very worst of ways.
What about the lawsuits in New York against him?
Well, those suits may succeed in holding the Trump company accountable. I would not count on them to hold Donald Trump himself accountable. And, you know, frankly, I'm disturbed that the Justice Department doesn't seem to be investigating serious allegations of criminality by the former president. And the most notable examples to me are the fact that there is a tape recording of Donald Trump on the phone with the Secretary of State in Georgia, trying to coerce him into coming up with 11,780 votes, just the exact number he would need to beat Joe Biden, that don't exist, and threatening that he may be prosecuted if he doesn't. If that were you or me or any of your listeners, they would be under investigation by the Justice Department. It should be no different for Donald Trump. And there was also an indictment in the Southern District of New York naming individual number one, who is Donald Trump, as having directed and coordinated a campaign fraud scheme in which Michael Cohen went to jail. And what's the argument for sending to jail the guy who was directed and coordinated, but giving a pass to the guy who did the directing and coordinating? If we take the position, as the Justice Department did for 4 years, that you can't indict a sitting president, which I think is the wrong policy, but you compound it by saying, as a practical matter, you can't prosecute a former president either, then the president does become above the law. And that is a dangerous proposition in the abstract. It's even more dangerous when that very person is running for president again.
Congressman Schiff, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, wonderful pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
That was Congressman Adam Schiff, Democrat from California. His new book is titled Midnight in Washington, How We Almost Lost Our Democracy and Still Could. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well, stay safe. I'm Diane Rehn.